The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. This is Tanya Salsa, and we are interviewing Aquania Escarne this morning. And Aquania is a really wonderful example of how you can do amazing things. I mean, she's a financial coach. She's in life insurance. She owns a hotel. She's a real estate investor. She's got her own podcast. I mean, she's an incredible wealth of just all kinds of things. Aquania, welcome to the show. How do you balance all this stuff? What's your story?
Thank you so much, Tanya, for having me today. I get that question a lot. And one of my greatest tools is my calendar, for one. And then I also spend a lot of my effort and energy on prioritizing what I should be doing and when. So I do plan family time. I do plan my weekends. I plan my weekdays. There are things that will throw me off, but it doesn't harm me as much if I have a plan of what I need to accomplish by the end of the day. And as long as I accomplish those top three things, everything else kind of falls into place or doesn't, but I just restart the next day. And that's really how I try to encourage people to think about it. You have to prioritize. I have to bring, you know, to light for myself and for others, because I'm very transparent with my schedule, with my family as well. This is the day that I'm working on my podcast. This is the day I'm going to meet with insurance clients. This is the hours that I'm going to focus on my 9-to-5, because I also have a 9-to-5. So we have to really, as people, make those types of decisions. And that's how we can put effort towards all of our goals.
Amazing. How did you get involved in all of these different things? I mean, you have several different things going on. How does your investment story start?
Very early, interestingly enough. Don't want to take you down the full memory lane, but I did start saving for retirement specifically at 16 years old. Wow. When I was in high school, my dad. This is what a lot of people ask themselves.
That was definitely not me either. My goodness. I don't even know what I did when I was 16, but not that. Wow. Amazing.
I mean, it was. For me, high school was good. But I will say one of the things that inspired me was my dad. I was a sophomore in high school, and he gave me a copy of Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki and was like, read it. My dad is a man of few words, and you listen to him when he speaks. So when he gave me the gift, I read the book and I immediately was like, I don't want to be an employee for the rest of my life. I want to be an owner. I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to be a real estate investor. So all of these things came into my head and I said, okay, let me start where I can, which is that summer I got a summer job. And it was at a retail store selling clothes, which could have been my weakness. I could have worked all these hours in a retail store and then used my paycheck to fill my closet. But instead, I took my first paycheck and I opened a Roth individual retirement account. And I pretty much told the bank, because I went to the bank and I said, look, this is what I want to do. And I remember the person telling me across the table, like, why are you doing this? You're so young. You know, why would you put your entire first paycheck towards retirement? And I said to her very clear, like, I don't want to work for the rest of my life. And I want to retire early. And this is well before the whole retire, you know, freedom.
Fire movement.
Right, mm-hmm. Fire movement, financial independence and retiring early movement, or at least to my knowledge. I didn't know it had a name at that time. And that's what I did. And I just said, you know, when I'm in school, I'll try to save my change. I'll try to save babysitting money. I'll make one deposit a year. Like, this was my goal. Every Christmas, whatever I was able to save, let's make a deposit. And then after that, I waited until I had more consistent income, and then I made monthly deposits. But that's how my journey started. My local high school wasn't up to my mother's standards. And so we looked for programs where I could get a better education and more access to better colleges. And that opportunity presented itself at Darlington School in Rome, Georgia. And when I went there, all of the people around me were coming from communities of wealth, except most of the minority students. And so I could have had FOMO in high school several times because most of the students got brand new cars at 16 and they were able to take family vacations and go on the school trips overseas to other places. And I wasn't necessarily in that position, but I found ways to accomplish what I wanted to accomplish. So for me, I did get a car in high school, but it wasn't until my senior year, and it was definitely not a brand new car. I drove a Toyota Cressida that was literally 1 year younger than I was when I bought it. And I needed my mom's help to get it. And then I had to work for my mom 1,000 hours. Like, she literally said, if you work for my company for 1,000 hours, you will cover the portion of the car that you need to pay for, and then you can have it. And so it was always working for something, working for a goal, working for a car, working for savings. So for me, I wasn't focused on the next car, the next dress, the next whatever. I was more so like, I want certain things so that I can have them for me and my friends, but I also don't want to prioritize material things. And so my friends will tell you, I was the one in high school who had money. I remember my best friend, we've been best friends since fifth grade, but we ended up going to the same high school because her mother also wanted better opportunities for her. And we both got into Darlington. And she got in a car accident. And I remember we got into the car accident in her aunt's car with her cousin. And when we got home that night, her aunt's immediate reaction was, I didn't get in a car accident, so who's going to pay my insurance deductible? Because I don't have it. And everybody looked around and then they looked at me and I was like, I can contribute, but I'm not going to be fully responsible. I wasn't driving. But it was still this concept that Aquania is probably in the best position to contribute to this. And I was. But it was also a lesson to them, like, you got to have money for an emergency. Like, things happen. And we may have to be responsible for them. So that was like an initial reaction to, or initial lesson in life, that you always need money for an emergency. You always need savings in general. And when life happens, that's what's going to save you. And so I've maintained those types of concepts most of my life.
Amazing.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
I mean, most people that have a full-time job are pretty much content to just leave it at that and then maybe have one side hustle. But you've got things that I don't know if I would even call them side hustles. I mean, they're like their own entity now. So tell us about how that journey happened.
So it all began for me in 2015. Interestingly enough, well, I'll say a little bit before that. In 2010, when I was assigned in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, and I had experienced the earthquake along with everyone else, I noticed very quickly that working professionals are not always prepared. And not only are they not prepared, sometimes they don't have savings, insurance, life insurance, property insurance. And now something unexpected, a natural disaster, has literally impacted their wealth, their personal assets. You know, they need to replace everything or they've lost their lives. And that was the initial wake-up call for me. Like, hey, I think the peers around me need help. I like to talk about money. I like to read money books. But at that time, I was keeping most of the knowledge to myself. And occasionally, family would ask me questions because they knew that I was the money nerd. Fast forward 5 years later, I came back from living 3 years in Dubai for work. And I read an article that said Americans don't have $400 saved for an emergency. And I was like, why? I want to understand, what is it that's preventing people from having this level of savings? And so it basically said, without $400 to $500 in an emergency fund, that is the amount of an expense that throws people's budget off and brings them to payday loans and other predatory lending in order to make ends meet. So that kind of really interested me. And I started with taking that information and sharing it on Facebook. And then I decided, why don't I try to encourage people to save with me? And I created a savings challenge that I started in June, and by the end of the year, we would have had $500 saved. So my goal was get people past 400. Let's just get the first five. And people were engaging. I would put up posts. I would tell people where they should be in the savings challenge each week. And then I would get messages like, oh my God, this is so helpful. I've been saving with you. I'm really inspired. I'm excited. I didn't know I could save this much. Thank you for showing me the way. And then one of my financial advisors was actually like, you really like this stuff. And I think that you could help people on a larger scale. Why don't you consider getting licensed to sell life insurance and then find a way to use that as a vehicle to help with everything else? And I was like, that's not a bad idea. How hard is it to get licensed? And he's like, not that hard. Take a test, pass, you're done. So that's what happened in 2016. I took a test. I passed. I started selling life insurance and using that as a vehicle to also introduce people to other money concepts. And then I ended up deciding to partner with my financial advisor and join his team so that he could then provide the financial planning side. So it would be a holistic practice to help people with their money. And we've been doing it ever since.
Wow. So you're continuing to do the life insurance sales even now then? You still do that? Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, but you also have some other stuff going on. Did that come out of what you did with life insurance?
Yes, I build on everything I do. And so I started investing in real estate probably like very aggressively in 2016 as well. That's the year my husband and I were able to get three properties in 1 year. And the reason we were able to do that is because for years we saved. We lived overseas, and while we lived overseas, we had tenants in our home, which then allowed them to pay down the mortgage and us to save what we would have saved for housing. So I took advantage of my ability to save the biggest expense in most people's budget, which is your rent or your mortgage fees.
Mm-hmm. Your and housing then, costs.
Exactly, the housing costs. And in addition to that, I've always been an aggressive saver. I obviously started early, but got my husband on board too. So a lot of the stuff that we did from the beginning of our marriage was on auto pay, like, you know, investing was automatic and monthly, and insurance was automatic and monthly. So a lot of wealth I built through life insurance. And that's another reason why I decided to pursue life insurance versus some other financial service, because I had the proof in the pudding. You saved a lot of money via life insurance, and you were able to put a large down payment on a Virginia home, buy a property in Philadelphia as a rental, and help my mother-in-law get a property for herself right before retirement. So we really saw the power. I turned it into my business, but I used my proceeds from my business and from my savings to purchase real estate, because at the end of the day, my father showed me through his real estate empire he built that this is a great way to maintain cash flow and assets and legacy rental income. Once you minus your expenses, that's what's left over for you as cash flow. And you can put that into whatever you want, including buying more properties. So in 2016, that was the plan: get our dream home, get a rental, and help mom get a house too. And that all went really well. And I maintained the rental in Philadelphia for quite some time. And then 2 years later, I sold it. And one of the reasons I sold it is because that experience taught me some things about even myself and how I felt about being a landlord. I will say the property that we lived in, that we knew what it did and what it didn't do and all the quirks about it, was a lot easier to rent than the one I never lived in. And part of it is because it was a different neighborhood and community. So the tenant themselves were a different caliber. That was easier to manage. The Philadelphia property, although affordable and a good cash flow property, had challenges. And we found ourselves, because I invested in that with someone else, we found ourselves just constantly at a disadvantage sometimes, because we'd have to go up there to check on stuff. And we had a property manager initially that wasn't the strongest property manager. So having to replace a property manager, find a better one, and then also evicting tenants. That was the first time I had to evict a tenant, and that didn't feel so great either. So after that experience, I kind of was looking for passive income, real estate opportunities. And I have to say, this is a plug for Tanya. Tanya was the one who opened my eyes to multifamily syndication, which led me to hotel ownership. And we can talk about that more next if you like.
Please do. Yeah, we're just listening here. And multifamily syndication, I think it's just starting to creep into people's consciousness. Like, what is that? And how do I do that? Right. So tell us a little bit about that part of your story.
Absolutely. So you and I had Tanya on my podcast, the Purpose of Money podcast.
Which is great, by the way. Yes. Everybody should listen.
And we talked about just investing in real estate and your journey. And afterwards, you introduced me to Paragon Partners who do multifamily syndication. And I had them on my podcast. And for those who don't know, multifamily syndication is investing in those large apartment subdivisions where you have hundreds, sometimes less than 100, but 100, 200 units. They're apartments. It's affordable housing in most cases, different levels, but people live there. And most people, even me, prior to learning about this opportunity, assumed that a corporation or one person owned these subdivisions. And I later learned that no, it's actually a group of investors. And there's people that look for opportunities to own these and then collect the rents and divide the profits and pay the profit dividends to investors. So once I learned that this was a way to be invested in real estate, but not have to deal with toilets and tenants, I was hooked. I was doing my research. I want to know how to do this. So I actually started putting my money in order so that I could be open to an opportunity that came along. So another lesson I want to teach people is you have to be financially prepared for when opportunities come along. You can't just wait until the opportunity comes because then you might not even have time to get your finances in order. So I started out months before I actually found an opportunity, making sure I had the money. Where was I going to get it from? Where was I saving it? Where was I going to hold it? And Paragon Partners was really explaining to me how you make money from multifamily syndications, but they didn't have any deals. Under 2020, for a lot of people, it was very difficult to find investment opportunities that were profitable. And that is kind of the point, is you want to get into something that eventually you're going to make more money than you put in. That's the point. And that's when I learned, because another mutual friend introduced me to Epic Collective, which is a group of women who invest in hotels. Davon Reeves has been in the hotel industry almost 15 years, and Jessica Myers has been in a real estate, commercial real estate and development for 5 to 6 years. And I was introduced to them, also invited them on my podcast. And then we started talking about how you actually buy hotels, because I never knew that hotels were also owned by investors and not these large corporations. There are some owned by corporations, but there's some owned by investors too. So we had a whole episode about it. I learned the numbers, you know, less than 2% of hotel owners are Black, let alone female. And I found these statistics to be startling. And I said to myself, this has to be an area where we can educate more people about it so that they can get involved. Now, when I had Epic Collective on my podcast, it was purely from an educational standpoint. I want to know how to invest in hotels so my audience can know how to invest in hotels. It wasn't planned that a month later, they would have an opportunity, a Hilton to be exact, that I could invest in. I signed up for their email list because I liked what they were doing and I wanted to support whatever ventures they had coming up if I could. And so I joke about this all the time. The first email they sent about investing in a Hilton, I missed it. I don't know what I was doing, very busy, didn't see the email. But they sent the email again and I saw it and I said, do I want to invest in a Hilton? And I said, yes, I do. Let me learn more about this. So something people need to understand is multifamily syndications, hotel opportunities, a lot of times they cannot be publicly advertised to the public. SEC thinks regular people see this, they may not wisely invest their money. So we have to limit it to people you know or people who are investors with enough money and wisdom to make wise investment decisions. And so being on the email list and being in a network where these types of deals is talked about is step number one. I happened to do that by meeting Tanya, who led me to Paragon Partners, who I was then introduced to Epic Collective. So networking was really important. But then once I saw the email, I signed up to get access to the prospectus on the deal. That's when I started to then ask a lot of questions. So I'm not one to say, oh, this sounds great. Let me give you my money now. No, let me ask even more questions. So if Devon or Jessica were here, they would tell you, I asked about 100 questions. And then research. I showed my husband. I had him share it with someone who looks at mergers and acquisitions and looked over the financials and said, oh, this looks really good. Like, you know, if I had the money, I would do it. And then the other thing is I took action. When they had the question and answer session, I participated. I asked even more questions. And then I did something that not everyone does, but I thought was important. I told other people. I told people in my circle that are women that had the income and were looking for opportunities to invest about the opportunity because I didn't want to do it alone. And I didn't think that it should be something I kept to myself. So I told my cousin, I told a sorority sister, I shared it with my own email list eventually. And about two people decided to do it. And I was like, okay. And once I gave the money, because you wire money, it goes in escrow, and then like any other real estate deal, you wait to close. So interestingly enough, I just kind of was like, okay, let's see what happens. But I always had that guarantee that if we don't close, we'll send you your money back. And I was like, okay. And then we closed. So October of last year, I became an investor in a Hilton Home 2 Suites in El Reno, Oklahoma. If you're ever in Oklahoma and you want to hang out in El Reno, please stay at my place.
Have you been there, by the way?
Yes.
Have you stayed there?
Yes, I have. So here's a couple things that I think would be helpful for people to know. Just like regular home real estate, location, the same applies to hotels. So one of the perks about this one is it's right off the highway. In 2020, a lot of people increased their road trips. So it's very accessible. You see it from the highway. It's right near a lot of restaurants that you can eat and kind of enjoy yourself. And El Reno's not the hottest town, but it is a town on the rise. There's tons of construction projects going on right now. So a lot of our initial guests are actually workers on those construction projects. Road tripper, you know, people taking road trips, and anyone else who happens to be in the area. There are also a lot of other hotels in the area, so the demand for inventory is there, but they're different. There's not another Home 2 Suites in the area. But from a real estate investor perspective, here's what made the deal attractive for me as an investor. For one, I had a motivated seller. The owner of the hotel owned 8 hotels. And in 2020, all of them experienced a reduction in profit. And therefore, he had an incentive to offload some of his hotels in order to make nice with his creditors, right? He needed to find a way to still balance his own portfolio. So he was motivated to sell. The other benefit to the deal is that just like you can approach some owners to take over their mortgages, we were able to approach him to take over his mortgage. So you're getting all of the equity, the valuable property, and not for the full price. So that was another benefit. And then you get to split that mortgage payment that is due amongst the other investors in the deal. But they structured it in a way that everyone pretty much knew, if I contribute this much money, my equity is going to be this much. And my timeline is 5 to 7 years. So hotels are a longer commitment. They do expect you to have it at least 5 years, sometimes 7 or as much as 10. It really just depends on the hotel itself and how it's operating. So I knew all of those things. I knew this was a longer term investment and I was prepared to do all of those things. But the location part, I only knew on paper. So once we did close and I went, I definitely checked out the rooms, the service, the pool. You know, what are people's reactions to staying in this hotel? I kind of was like a fly on the wall in the beginning because I didn't put hotel owner on my forehead when I checked in. The staff knew, obviously.
But not you give the VIP guests. Treatment, the red carpet rolled out for you.
I didn't pay to stay at the hotel. And we did a tour of competitor hotels too. So when we went, we looked at other properties. We also looked at what's in the neighborhood, what are some attractive features. And, you know, we brainstormed and talked about how the operator, because just like you can get a property manager for homes, you get a property manager for hotels. How does the property manager plan to boost sales? What types of contracts are they going to put in place to attract long-term stays, like construction workers working on projects? So we talked about all of that, and that's kind of how it all came together. But the part that made the biggest difference in my life and making it realistic to others is I took my son. I took my 10-year-old son with me, and I took him because I wanted him to understand why mommy works so hard, what mommy's working on, and what type of legacy I'm building for him. And as a 10-year-old, he really focuses on YouTube, video games, and school. But that trip kind of opened his eyes to my mommy can own a hotel. And he had the opportunity to meet some of the people that worked there. And I had that opportunity too. And I would say that was the most rewarding part of buying a hotel. The profits in the future and selling it and all that, that's great. But the impact I made to people that at a time where they were really struggling, if the owner had to sell or close the hotel, you would have seen tons of people, dozens of people lose their jobs. But then I also learned when we went to visit that prior to our ownership, they had no 401ks, no vacation time, and no sick leave. If you took a day off work, you didn't get paid, period. And there were some people who couldn't afford to take off work. So they had worked nonstop for the last year. And some of them worked because they didn't want to not work. And then because of COVID, suddenly be found dispensable.
And get laid off. Yeah,
exactly. So we show up and they're like, the new operator on day one implemented the 401k. It was like,
wow,
we've never operated a hotel where employees didn't have this benefit. Gave them vacation leave, gave them sick leave. And they were like amazed, happy, overjoyed. And I was overjoyed. I was literally emotionally moved by it because I'm someone who's coaching people to save for retirement. And I had a hotel where people weren't able to do that. And most people don't save outside of their employer unless they know how to do it. So that should be where you start. And I had people who didn't even have a place to start. So now they do. So that was amazing. And the primary manager that had been running the place finally got to take a family vacation, paid family vacation. That's life-changing for a lot of people. So that is ultimately the biggest impact. And I'm proud that I could be invested in real estate and have a greater impact. When I first became a real estate investor, I wanted to provide quality homes to people because homes are important. Homes give you stability. That's where you live. But now I'm providing jobs to people and retirement accounts to people and a safe place to stay for people. That's huge. That's taking my initial vision and it's just multiplying it.
I love that story. I think that's amazing. I think that's really, I mean, the ideal in investment, right? I mean, something that gives you a return and makes an incredible impact in people's lives in a very positive way. What a wonderful story.
Thank you. I love it. And then the fact that now we have 5 female hotel owners, maybe even more, it's me. 5 female hotel owners that are women of color is amazing. That really makes me excited and inspires me to talk about this more so that people can become hotel owners themselves if they want to and find ways to make money in real estate, but don't have to be involved in that day to day. So I didn't get a special elevator, but I do, as a Hilton hotel owner, I do get discounts on Hilton stays, and I don't pay to stay at that location, Home 2 Suites in El Reno, Oklahoma. Check it out. And I do get dividends, quarterly dividends, as you know, throughout the time in which we own the property, and we get access to the financials. So I'm well aware of how the hotel's operating. We have meetings where we talk about the numbers and the plans to do better and how everything's going to work. The other perk is I do not have to deal with the day-to-day. I don't have to make sure people show up to work or sheets are changed or guest complaints are addressed. But I do ask about that stuff. I do check on it. I'm always looking online on the reviews. There's things that I do that I don't have to, but I choose to. And that's part of just protecting my investment. But there's several ways to invest in hotels, actually. Hotels are considered commercial real estate. So they are a great way to get involved and make profits, but you do have other people who are kind of managing that day to day for you. And so one way to do it is to network and make friends, be in the network of someone who manages hotels or buys hotel deals like Epic Collective. They're on social media, but their Epic is E-P-I-Q instead of C, E-P-I-Q Collective. So you can join their list. Another way is you can invest in real estate investment trusts or REITs, R-E-I-T. REITs are, you know, organizations that invest in deals, collect with other people. They pool money together and then they purchase commercial properties, including multifamily syndications and hotels. And in REITs, you are buying equivalent of shares. So whatever money you put into a REIT, you get a portion of ownership and then you get dividends as well. I like REITs because they're required to pay the investors a majority of the money they make. I think 90% or so, whatever they make has to be redistributed to the investors. So that's one way to invest in hotels, again, without having to be in the day-to-day. But when you invest in that way, you're not getting the hotel perks directly. You're just getting the profits from the dividends. There are private and there are public REITs. You can Google them. I'm invested in one that's private. So you do have to kind of like be in that club, but the investment at the time when I joined was low. But you can also, some of them are publicly traded like stocks too. So you can go to E-Trade or any type of brokerage that has access to the REIT and then purchase shares in that REIT as well. A third option is you actually go buy a hotel. You can look around, see if one's for sale. If the person's willing to sell it and you want to do the day-to-day, you can buy it. You can pool money together with other investors and buy it, or you can buy it outright. And there are some people, that's what they want to do. So that's another way to do it. So there's a couple of ways. Obviously, the third option is the most intensive because you are the owner, you are the front desk, you are the day-to-day. But the other two options, you are financially involved, but you're less hands-on. So obviously, when I go to the Home 2 Suites in El Reno, I'm not painting the walls. I can't even pick the colors of the paint on the wall, okay? Hilton pretty much sets the standards. They say our Home 2 Suites have to be refurbished this many years at a time. So every 5 to 7 years, they have this color scheme. They have this art palette. They have this furniture. That's pretty much set. And I will say, when you purchase a hotel, you don't have to purchase ones that are already branded. But for me, I thought it was a good incentive because one, people know Hilton, they know the brand. And there are some people who will stay at that brand because it's the one they're loyal to or they have the loyalty program with. Whereas you could buy a hotel, it could be Aquania Suites, right? And you could stay at Aquania Suites if you want to. But it doesn't necessarily have that connection or that advertising and other things come with it. Whereas with the Hilton, you do pay for the name. You pay a portion of your monthly fees, includes licensing for the name. But then you get the website, you get the traffic by loyalty association and all those other things that come with buying a franchise, quote unquote, you know, something that has a name that people know. So for me, 2020 was like, get out of landlord real estate. Not completely. I still own rentals, but I want passive real estate investing opportunities to come my way. I literally was like, I want to know more. So I asked Tanya a lot of questions. I asked my friends and Paragon Partners a lot of questions. I asked Epic Collective a lot of questions. I didn't know what the deal was, but like I said, I put the money aside and I waited. And when the opportunity comes, I'm going to swoop it up. And that's what I think people need to have, is a big plan. I want to accomplish X, Y, and Z by the end of the year. But give yourself the flexibility to also be open to opportunities, and then research those opportunities before you take the leap. I love that I've been able to be ready when these things came along, but it definitely was years in the making as far as the mindset, the resources, the money, you know. There's things I did in my 20s that, because I did them in my 20s, I can live my best life in my 30s. So that's what I think is important. The rental property in Philadelphia was a gift and a curse. So the gift was, it's so funny. I was talking to someone at work. She said to me, she was buying a house in Philadelphia, and we work in DC. So I was like, why are you buying a house in Philadelphia? And she said, because my husband and I go to Philadelphia like every other weekend because we went to Temple and all our friends are there, and hotels for the weekend are so much more expensive than a mortgage. And I said, well, how much more expensive? And she was like, well, the house we're looking at, the mortgage is like $350 a month. I was like, what?
Yeah, right. That's definitely cheaper than a hotel.
Right. And Tanya, that is the same reaction I had. And I was like, what kind of house are you buying for $350 a month?
I know. Like, are you going to be like, okay there? Should we check on you?
Exactly. So interestingly enough, she was like, a row house, 3 bedrooms, 1.5 baths. So she starts listing the perks. And I'm like, wait a minute. Who's your realtor? Literally, who's your realtor? I want to meet this person. I made a phone call. She introduced me. We drove up to Philly. We saw 5 houses in one Saturday. And the last one was another motivated seller. It was a family who had an estate. The previous owner was their father. He passed away after living in the house for 20 years. Nobody wanted this house. Nobody wanted to live in this house. And I had cash. So I was like, I'll buy it. I'll take it off your hands. Now, at the time, that was the best way to buy it because I outbeat any person who came to the table with a mortgage. I could close in 10 days or less, and they gave me a good deal. I think we paid $35,000 for this.
What?
3-bedroom, 2-bath residence. And previous owner, same person for the last 20 years. I couldn't have asked for a better home. The downside was a 1920 home. So this is not a new home. This is not a shiny new home. But it has solid bones and, you know, structure, foundation, everything was good. I still got an inspection. I wasn't crazy. We kind of went in and said, all this needs is probably an updated kitchen and some new floors. So we thought. So here's the thing. I jumped in, eyes wide open, super excited. I invested in that property with my cousin. So we were all excited. We started to make it pretty. And I'll tell you this, when you have an old home and you're trying to make it pretty, you start pulling up walls and floors, you will find things.
Oh, yes.
So
surprise.
So that was one of the things, you know, I had to learn, you know, have your extra cushion for your renovation funds and be prepared to hire and fire contractors. We went through a few in our first project, and we started with, who do you know, realtor, to help us do this? Who do you recommend? But we ended up finding some really good people that we worked with long term to handle any of the maintenance that came later. So there were positives and negatives. The negative was, our reno took a little longer than we expected. We weren't able to just flip that house and put a tenant in it. Once we pulled up the floors, we found termites. That became something you had to treat, whatever, whatever. But we treated it and it was fine. It was a good cash flow property in the beginning. But the neighborhood was a solid neighborhood in that most people on the block owned it. So they were very protective of it. So when we came in as investors, which they didn't know, it's not, again, didn't put investor on my forehead, but definitely was there a lot more and people started to take notice. But the captain of the neighborhood watch introduced herself. And then people, when they realized we weren't living there yet, would help us by putting out the trash. It was really cool. So nice neighborhood, nice neighbors. But neighborhood was still in transition. So the tenant that we attracted the first time around was actually pretty good. You know, it was a solid person who didn't have the best credit, but they had the potential and they wanted a safe place to live. But we did face issues when they came into financial difficulty because of loss of income. And that's when we experienced our first eviction. And as someone who had never had to evict someone before, that was pretty traumatic for me because it's not something you want to do. But I had to learn very quickly that the more grace you give someone and they're not paying you, the more it's costing you in the long run. And so that was a lesson I had to learn in order to not have to deal with losses like that later. So taking action. The other things that I had to do was learn the rules of what happens when you are out of state landlord and you're trying to evict someone in another state and hiring a lawyer to help with that and all the different things that come with evicting someone. But great lessons. Got a second tenant. Eventually, it took a couple of months. So we had a couple of months of no income, but it didn't really bother us because the house was, again, paid in cash. So we didn't have anyone that we were paying a mortgage to or anyone was looking for a mortgage payment. So that was good. But it was stressful, you know, and in that transition between tenants, we also looked for a different property manager because that's when I really learned not all property managers are the same and you have to know what you need. So the first property manager, we kind of went with them because they helped us find the property and they seemed like the best fit. But once we realized we needed more hands-on support because we don't live in Philadelphia and that property manager was not the full support team we needed, that's when we realized, okay, we need to change property managers and we need to specifically look for one that will do everything and has a team to do everything. So the second property manager had a whole contracting team to do renovations, had a whole team to find more investment properties if you wanted more, had a whole team to deal with eviction. So much larger property manager, much more services. And that's kind of what worked. That's when we realized, okay, this is what we need. And the only reason we decided to still sell and get out of the Philadelphia market is because another investor came along, offered us a cash deal to get out and was well worth the numbers for us, was well worth it. So we just decided, okay, let's just get out of this property and transition into something else. And the something else happened to be hotels because my cousin invested in a hotel with me as well. But that came like a year later. I love it. So in 2018, I launched thepurposeofmoney.com, which is a blog that was sharing my money stories and money tips to help women specifically level up their finances. I was inspired to create my website after attending FinCon, which is a financial conference for money influencers and those who like to talk about money. So it was like my playground. You know, money nerds love FinCon. And after a few years of running a blog, a lot of people were like, you should have a podcast. I mean, it's faster to talk than it is to write. You can reach more people and you can share different types of stories if you want to. And I thought about it and eventually gave in and said, you know, I do want to do that. And in January of 2020, I launched my podcast where initially, I was talking about my money stories as well, but then I wanted to highlight women entrepreneurs who are creating more wealth or freedom for themselves, and they are not necessarily the stories that you hear about everywhere. So I was targeting women who hadn't told their stories or didn't know where to tell their story, but they had accomplished something that other people could learn from. And that's what I do. I share women wealth building stories on the podcast and how they did it so that if you are a mom, a wife, a woman, and you want to replicate that success, you can. And I really try to highlight people who are still working as well, or who have fully transitioned, because that's where I am. I'm working and I want to fully transition to entrepreneurship. And I was like, if these are stories I want to hear, then these are stories I want my listeners to hear too. So I've had the podcast for a while now, and it's been great meeting people, sharing those stories, and really using that platform to connect with more people who are able to learn and grow from the stories they hear.
So I have a question, actually, because I've talked to other people who during their investment journey have, and this is a little bit changing gears for a bit, but who are not sure whether they should take out money from their TSP. This is a bit of a random question, but you know, you talk a lot about savings, and sometimes, you know, people's main savings is in their TSP. Do you have strong thoughts either way on whether you should or should not borrow from your TSP?
Yes, but everything depends on your particular situation. So I'm going to preface this by saying I am not giving specific financial advice. I do not know everyone's individual situation. I am going to be very transparent in that for the hotel investment, I borrowed from my TSP, but I didn't borrow. I withdrew from my TSP. But here's why I did it, and here's why it worked for me. What I took out of my TSP was not a majority of what I had in the account. So if you are someone who's just starting out and you're trying to make a withdrawal to purchase a home or to do anything, and that is a majority of what you have saved, you should not be withdrawing money from your retirement account. You should be saving more money for whatever you're trying to accomplish. So if that's buying your first home or your next rental, you need to save more. But if you're able to take from your retirement account what it might be equivalent to 10 to no more than 20%, and you still have a significant amount of money saved, it might be something to consider and talk through with a professional. In my case, I didn't withdraw it and go spend it somewhere else. I withdrew it and I put it into another retirement account that actually allows me the flexibility to invest in alternative investments like hotels, real estate, Bitcoin, land, gold, silver. It's called a solo 401k. My specific account is called an EQRP. It's an enhanced qualified retirement account. So the IRS has defined it as a retirement account. It is a place to save for your future. You can put up to $57,000 a year into it, and you're allowed to invest it in other investments that can make you more money. So what I essentially did was I moved money from one retirement account to another, but now I have control over it. And in the solo 401k, I decide where it's invested. The other benefit is because of the performance of the market the year I withdrew the money, that money is not missed. Like I took out the money, it was a withdrawal. So my balance was reduced by the amount I withdrew. And then the profits that I made in the retirement account last year completely replaced it. So yes, you could argue, oh, well, you would have made more if you had kept the money in the retirement account, which I would have, but then I wouldn't have had the flexibility to invest it in the things that I wanted to invest it in. So in my situation, it made the most sense, but I even talked it over with my own financial advisor before I did it, right? Like, let's make sure I'm still on track to have what I need to retire. I couldn't promise that when I took the money, I would literally double my return in the market, but that's because the market did extremely well. But it was something that I did say to myself, what I am investing this money in is still going to exceed, based on the projections, my investment goals for this amount of money. So it's still worth it. So basically I made the informed decision that even though I'm taking money out of my retirement account, I'm putting it into an investment that has the potential to triple. And at the time I was like, I'm only going to make this decision if I can at least double my money. But I still know that every investment comes with risk, right? You always have the potential to lose money. So the other thing that I had to think was, if I lost this money, would I still be able to retire? And the answer was yes. But my situation is different because I started early. I've maxed out as much as I could in retirement, and I've accumulated enough wealth in my retirement assets that they can continue to grow well with or without the money I withdrew. Yeah, go ahead. But that's what it comes down to. If you're going to take money out, why are you taking it out? Is there any other place you can take it from first? I didn't want to use my cash assets to invest in a hotel because I knew I could use a retirement account to do it. But for other people, I would say determine if there's another source you can pull it from before you do pull from retirement, and then talk with a professional to see what makes the most sense from a tax perspective too. Because for me, I also avoided tax penalties by reinvesting the money into a retirement account. But some people take money out of retirement accounts and they don't put it in tax advantage products. So they end up maybe facing penalties that is an additional cost to them. And so that's why you should really talk to someone before you do it. Yes, thepurposeofmoney.com. I'm on Instagram at thepurposeofmoney, and I'm on Twitter at purpose_money. You can find me on social media where I'm sharing my money stories. I'm also occasionally tweeting and ranting about money things, but that's what I love to do. And you can always connect with me on thepurposeofmoney.com. Press connect, send me an email, and we can start a conversation if you want to talk about your own money situation.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.